This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Influential saxophonist and conductor Eric Hewitt has been let go from the Boston Conservatory at Berklee over allegations of abusive behavior and sexual assault. In a report released by the Boston Globe just this afternoon, several former students accused Hewitt of bullying and lewd phone calls. In one case, a woman told the Globe that Hewitt had taken her to his apartment, offered her drinks, and had sex with her as her consciousness faltered. Boston Conservatory Executive Director Kathy Young said in a statement that, quote, Hewitt will not be returning to the conservatory. Last year, Boston Conservatory merged with Berklee College of Music, and Berklee has been dealing with its own sexual harassment crisis, including allegations that the music school has a, quote, pervasive culture of tolerance for harassment, according to one student. Well, earlier today, I spoke with Berklee President Roger Brown. We met for an extensive interview before the news about Eric Hewitt's dismissal broke. Brown has been president at Berklee for 13 years. Last month, he revealed that over that time, almost a dozen faculty members have been fired for sexual misconduct. So I began by asking Roger Brown how many of those cases had he been personally aware of before last month.
All of them. I mean, I was involved in the process by which they were investigated and terminated.
Okay, interesting. So in that case, I mean, what's your response to some folks who might wonder, well, if you had 11 in 13 years, was there a point at which you thought maybe there's a deeper problem here?
Yeah. Well, first, let me set some context. Some people are unaware of the scope of this institution. We have 650 faculty at Berklee College of Music, about 250 at the conservatory. Yes, as I said, 11 is too many. And if I look back on it and say, what might I change? I think that we were very adamant about trying to get people to come forward and file complaints if they felt like they had been mistreated in some way. We were very proactive about addressing those and terminating people. But I think the realization I've had post the Me Too movement is just how ubiquitous this behavior is, just how baked into our culture it is for men with power to take advantage of that power. And how, unless we do something deeper than just adjudicate cases and try to actually change the culture, we're just going to continue to find people who cross the line and terminate them.
Right. So this question of power is really central because, you know, when you think about, I'm trying to put myself in the place of how a victim might feel. Yeah. That first of all, they've had this interaction with someone who already has power, and then they're asked to go and speak to people, come forward to people who have even more power, right? When we're talking about university administration. You know, I was looking back at the coverage that the Boston Globe has been doing, and I'm just wondering what your response is to a couple of specific things about how folks in the past have said Berklee has handled some of these these cases. Like, the Globe reported that the former student who reported being assaulted by one teacher, Jeff Galindo, she told the Globe that Berklee administrators initially discouraged her from pressing forward with a court case because Galindo would be dismissed. And I bring this up because of this question of power again. So, I mean, is that what happened? And if so, why would Berklee do that?
Yeah, it's hard to dispute the experience of a survivor and say that didn't happen or it did, because I wasn't there when those conversations happened. I can tell you one of the complicating things here is a student may talk to another faculty member or a staff member as a friend or to another student, and they may get advice that's not the official advice we give them as part of our equity investigation system. Not everyone is as fully educated about how this works. Every faculty member is a responsible party, and now, according to our policy, they're required to bring a complaint forward. But I think one of the things the Globe reported is the survivor said she went to another faculty member who said, you know, don't report this. Just, you know, and that's not consistent with the way the policies are written or should work, but I have to acknowledge that it happens sometimes. So what we're trying to do is create multiple pathways for anyone who has been victimized to come forward, report it, be sure that it can be investigated properly. If they want to go to the police or the authorities outside the college, that's absolutely their right. We never want to discourage that. In fact, we'd sort of want to encourage it. Because in a truly egregious case, we have limited sanctions. You know, we can't convict someone and send them to jail. So if someone does something truly egregious, it probably should go to the criminal justice system. So, you know, I'll be the first to admit that both our policies have improved dramatically. 3 years ago, we did a top-to-bottom review of our equity policies, put in a state-of-the-art system. We hired an outside consultant who helped us sort of study best practice at other institutions. So the system is constantly changing, improving, and evolving, but it's still an imperfect system.
So let me just ask you directly. Does Berkeley have a systemic problem with sexual misconduct amongst its faculty?
You know, it's hard for me to evaluate. Is 11, how does that compare to other institutions? Candidly, Magna, I think what we're seeing is this problem is ubiquitous everywhere. And we're seeing it lots of other colleges. And frankly, we're seeing cases where people brought complaints forward a decade ago and nothing was done and the person is still teaching there. At least at Berkeley, when a complaint was brought forward, we terminated the person at the time. Now, some students will say it took too long to do the investigation, but we have to do an investigation. There has to be some due process for the accused so that we can, you know, have a fair determination of what we believe happened. So, you know, all I can say is that we've had too much of this at Berkeley. Our students need to feel safe. They need to feel like they can trust faculty and staff and others to have their best interests at heart. And we're going to do everything possible to do the work to make it a better and safer place.
You know, I feel like this moment culturally that we find ourselves in now, it's a long time coming. And in a way, I'm glad that we're here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it requires empathy. It requires nuance, and it requires accountability.
Yep.
It just so happens that we have a lot of specific cases here at Berkeley. And so on this issue of, you know, there's the culture writ large, and then there's the culture on any individual campus. And I just want to read you one more thing. This is from a case that was filed with the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination earlier this year, at the beginning of this year. And a former student told MCAD that she had brought forth complaints against a coworker in one of the audio labs that she worked with. And Berkeley administrators had acted and said they'd monitor this person after they'd ordered the person to stay away from her, although that the former student alleges that the person did not stay away from her. But anyway, to the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination, she said that she continued to observe and experience a pattern, practice, and pervasive culture of tolerance of sexual harassment at Berkeley. I mean, would you agree or disagree with that characterization?
If that's her experience, I can't disagree with it. Do we tolerate sexual harassment or assault? No. If someone reports it, we investigate it. We discipline people if the behavior is less severe than would require termination. And to me, the fact that we've terminated 11 people long before all this broke is a sign that we have taken this very seriously. And I think among our community, people know we take it seriously. So at this point, you know, I'm trying very hard for us as a community to not be defensive.
Yeah.
And to say, look, this is the full catastrophe we're in the middle of right now. What do we do to take advantage of the fact that we have everyone's attention? The world is understanding that this abuse of power is not limited to one institution or one sector of the economy. What do we do to change the behavior? So rather than adjudicate cases and investigate and terminate people, how do we stop the behavior from happening in the first place?
So very important set of questions off what you just said, because part of what I think or what I believe folks would say is necessary is more sunlight, right? I mean,
yeah.
Look, I'm a journalist. I'm always going to say we need more sunlight.
Right.
But I also try to look at patterns. And again, this is from, you know, the reporting that's come from the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
I'm seeing at least three cases in which some kind of settlement was reached by Berkeley and the various parties. But in each of those cases, a gag order was also included in the settlement. So if accountability and sunlight and creating a culture where people can talk about these things is important, why the gag orders?
See, I dispute those facts. I don't think that's accurate.
What part's not accurate?
In no case have we said to a survivor, you cannot talk about this case. So I assume that's what the reporter meant by gag orders. We've settled a couple of lawsuits where we had non-disclosure agreements around the settlements, which is very common practice, and I suspect the Boston Globe itself does that. But we didn't say to a survivor, you can't talk about this to the media. That's the very reason the media are doing these stories. And we have not called a survivor and said, we're going to sue you because you violated some gag order. So that's not a practice of ours. And, you know, another thing that the media alleged is that somehow we gave a positive reference to one of these faculty members so he could go teach at New England Conservatory, which is also false. We shared his employment records that said he was terminated for sexual misconduct.
When they asked
for a reference. And I have publicly committed that going forward, anytime our human resources department is called and asked for a reference, if someone has been terminated for sexual assault or sexual misconduct, we will report that. No institution I know of terminates someone and does a press release and says this person was terminated for sexual harassment. Maybe we as a culture and a society need to move in that direction. But to somehow say we were using settlements and gag orders to cover this up is just really unfair.
So to be clear, I want to be sure I understand you correctly. Yeah. Around specific legal settlements, there are non-disclosure agreements about the terms of the settlement.
Yes.
Okay.
So our intention has not been to prevent people who want to talk about this from coming forward.
It's interesting because the Globe, in one of these cases, spoke with or tried to speak with both the student and the student's lawyer, and they both seem to have come away with the understanding that there's a gag order around.
If that was one of the lawsuits, that may be true. I wouldn't call it a gag order. I'd call it a non-disclosure agreement. But, yes, I mean, in the cases of lawsuits, we did have non-disclosure agreements that we have to abide by as well. One of our main goals is to protect the privacy of the complainant or the survivor. Everyone in Title IX work will tell you that the thing that will chill people coming forward is if they feel like they're going to end up in a newspaper when they don't want to be. So we're trying to make sure that whatever we do is respectful of the survivor and his or her need for privacy. It's just not accurate to say that we have gag orders on survivors.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about 3 years ago, but right now, what do you think are the most urgent changes that Berkeley should be making to make every student and let's be honest, every faculty member feel as confident and safe as possible?
I'd put them in two distinct categories. One is a system of reporting and investigation and sanctioning that is state-of-the-art, runs as well as it can possibly run, invites people to come forward if they have concerns, invites bystanders to come forward, even if the victim or survivor is unwilling to come forward. A roommate, a friend, a faculty member, a trusted person can come forward and say, I heard this. It makes it harder to investigate, but the more we can get people to share what has happened to them through a system where it can be investigated, the better off we'll be. But as I said earlier, the realization I've had is that is not enough. We need a top-to-bottom approach to culture change that educates people in our community about where the boundaries are as a respected faculty member or staff member, what abuse of power looks and feels like, not just egregious cases of it, but microaggressions where a student from another country might feel disrespected, a student who worships a different religion might feel disrespected, a person with different abilities or a transgender student, all these microaggressions that exist, we need to clean up our act and make sure that we're respectful of every student who comes here because we can't expect her or him to be their creative best if they're feeling like they're not even supported by this institution.
Now, how are you going to do that, though?
Well, we've put together a working group with 12 students, 6 faculty, 6 staff. We're going to meet twice a month for the next year. We have a plan that starts with, and we haven't made all these decisions yet, and I don't want all this to be top down, so I want the working group to come together, but we've had a bunch of great suggestions. I've met with hundreds of students, faculty, and staff since all this has been happening. So one idea is, should we collectively generate a statement of values and ethics that addresses some of this, and every one of us agree to sign that statement and live by it? Should we try to educate our students better about where those boundaries are, so that if they feel like a person is often predators, based on what I've learned, will start with a very subtle encroachment into someone's private space and see what happens. So how do we create firm boundaries so both the faculty and staff as well as the students know when a boundary crossing has happened, So I think more education, more dialogue, more discussion. We have a faculty development effort for a day and a half in January called Berkeley Teachers on Teaching. And we've basically tuned that whole training session to equity and these issues of harassment and assault.
You told the Boston Globe, I believe, that Berkeley is going to seek out a nationally renowned consultant. Mm-hmm. This is the Globe's language on federal sexual abuse and harassment laws. Can you tell us who that person is yet?
We've identified someone. She used to do this work for the University of Southern California and then for the entire UC system. And she is going to help us both look at some individual investigations and make sure we did those properly. And then also help advise the working group about sanctioning policy. You know, what kind of sanctions should be applied to which kind of behavior. So she is identified, and she's already begun her work.
Can you tell us who she is?
Jody Shipper is her name.
Okay. Another thing about faculty vetting, because again, I'm thinking about lessons learned from cases that Berkeley has has had to grapple with. I mean, there was the case of Steve Kirby, who's now a former Berkeley professor, who had a history of sexual abuse in Canada that Berkeley didn't know about until
moments after we hired him.
Yeah, so that makes me but people in Canada had to reach out to Berkeley, if I understand, and let you know. So are you going to change how you vet?
Can I first start
faculty?
By saying there's another Steve Kirby employed at Berkeley who is not this person. He is a wonderful faculty member, and it's been hard on him through this period. But, yes, we hired a faculty member from the University of Manitoba. We checked two faculty references. We did a criminal background check. We asked him explicitly, have you ever been investigated for harassment or assault? He said no. We hired him literally days later. An article appeared in the Winnipeg Register saying he has been terminated for sexual harassment. And so we put him on leave within 24 hours of learning that. We called the University of Manitoba for information. They said, I'm sorry, we can't disclose that.
They wouldn't disclose
They would not disclose
So that. Even if you had asked them beforehand,
they might have said no comment.
Was he dismissed?
They might have said no comment, and we might have said, that's concerning. So what we did is we did our own homework, and we found some survivors who were willing to share the investigative report, and based on that information, we terminated him.
But what about in vetting future faculty who may come to Berkeley?
So, we will certainly always call the HR department. If I step back and look at the process, that was a step we should have taken that we didn't. And I think we're going to do more thorough background checks. The trouble is, as you probably know, most of these never become part of someone's criminal record. So a criminal background check often doesn't unearth a finding like this. So we're just going to be more diligent than ever, and particularly that step of doing an official inquiry with HR. And I do think it's worth, from a human resources point of view, a larger societal discussion about what do you disclose, what are you able to disclose. There's a huge amount of case law of institutions being sued by people who were terminated. The reasons were given to a future employer, and they ended up having to pay large settlements to the person who they shared that information about. So I think that's an issue that is bigger than just Berkeley, bigger than just higher education.
So I'm... Last two questions.
Okay.
I'm getting back to this issue, the fundamental core issue of power here.
Okay.
A while ago, we spoke with a lawyer and actually a law professor in New York State because he was asked by the New York State legislature to come up with a system of handling this exact issue up there because they had scandal after scandal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he suggested and they did is they actually now have an independent investigator who doesn't work at the legislature. And in fact, it's this person. He's a law professor at City University of New York. So he's external to the system. But if someone has a complaint or a concern, they can go to him. Mm-hmm. So it creates an atmosphere of greater confidence and trust that a fair investigation will take place. Is that something that Berkeley would be open to?
We're putting everything on the table, and that's part of what the working group is going to look at. We have used some people for external investigations, but we haven't had a system where people report directly to an external organization. If that's what it takes, we'll do it. I feel like we're making it really widely known how you report, and I think students are coming to trust the system better. But whatever it takes, that's what we're prepared to do.
Can this be fixed, you think?
Fixed, no. Can it be radically changed and improved? Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we've made progress. I think we made a lot of progress before Harvey Weinstein. But I think this is a moment in time. This is a reckoning. And I want to be as strong and clear and ethical as I can possibly be in saying, if we get through this and do this right, we'll not only make this a better place, but we're sending our students off into the music industry, dance, theater industries, which have been notorious for exploiting young artists. So maybe our students can take the activism they've learned here out into those communities and say, let's make these worlds better. Let's stop this kind of exploitation.
Well, President Brown, thank you so very much for talking with me today.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Roger Brown is the president of Berklee College of Music. I spoke with him earlier today. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.